Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 3rd, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Ann Peterson. Today's session number is 5 and is titled Fire and Faith. Let's listen in.
I'm Ann Peterson, and this is a session entitled Fire and Faith, a metaphor for living in the questions. Well, about 130 people left this morning, and I think about 130 some came up again. So the transition in the village over the weekend has taken place. I have been up here 1 week now and am finishing. This is the last session in a week that has been titled Where in the World is God? An examination of Norman MacLean's book, Young Men in Fire. I'll try to fill you in. How many of you are new here for the first time this session? Okay, I'll try to give you some clues. You'll be able to catch tonight's without having been here the rest of the week, I think. So, I teach at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Any South Dakotans? We seem to be few and far between up here, but there's a few of us. And we have been spending the week discussing the question, in the midst of pain and suffering and tragedy, where do you find God in the world? Where do you find God in the world? And the subtext that I've been using to kind of raise that question during the week, and I guess I've done a good enough job that the bookstore is sold out of these, so if you want to read it, you'll have to wait till you go home. Norman MacLean's book, Young Men and Fire, the essay about a forest, just a brief two-sentence biography of Norman MacLean, who taught at University of Chicago for a number of years and wrote A River Runs Through It. For some of you, that's probably more familiar than this book. This was published after his death. It's about the death of 13 young firefighters out of a crew of 15. Three men survived in a forest fire in the Mann Gulch area in southwest Montana. In 1949, right about now. I think the fire broke out on August 5th. This book is a narrative of MacLean's struggle to find out what happened, what caused the fire, what caused the firefighter's death, and sort of the aftermath of the fire. How did the families deal with these young men's death? Most of these firefighters were in their late teens, early 20s. So the title of the tragedy, of course, is Young Men and Fire. And the theme of the fire goes through the book in a rather interesting way. MacLean senses the ambiguity, and we're going to talk about fire as sort of a metaphor for faith. So the first session we looked at Where in the World is God, talked about suffering and evil and God's presence in the world. The second session, I took MacLean's example of his writing in his book. He spends a lot of time searching in the story through the details of the fire and through the science of firefighting. In fact, I learned a whole lot more about firefighting than I probably ever wanted to know, but it's a lengthy examination of the causes of this fire. And I took that as a metaphor for how one might think theologically about your own Christian faith. That is, reflecting on the details of your life and allowing yourself to reflect on the questions that arise out of that. And that's what MacLean really does in this book, is after examining the details of this tragedy, questions rise out of the ashes, almost like prayers of lament, that he begins to struggle with religious and spiritual issues out of this fire, like, why these young men? What came out of this tragedy? What kind of good can we say come out of it? Why does it happen to sort of the destructiveness of the fire? And of course, it's ambiguous because a lot of us know that forest fires are also good. And I've mentioned to a couple of the classes, having been through the Yellowstone fire, any of you get a chance to witness the Yellowstone fire a few years ago? It was a powerful scene. A lot of the local Montanans, we were coming out to visit my mom, and so we drove up into the fire and spent a couple nights up there before the areas were shut down, and you drove out in your headlights. I mean, it was just an amazing sense, almost overwhelmed a little bit by feelings of suffocation. You could see the clouds of smoke rising up in the distance. And then the next year we came back, and after the fire has cleared through that area, of course, there's all kinds of new growth. So the fire has both positive and negative effects. The tragedy, of course, for this is that these 13 young men lost their lives. I talked with some people last night who had friends or family or knew people who died in the Colorado fire. What has it been, about 2 years ago now? Two, 3 years ago? Again, which there were about the same number of young people who died, including this time, I think, a couple women smoke jumpers. So this image of fire is where we'll kind of tie up loose ends tonight with this session. I have basically three goals for it. The first is to talk about the image of fire, just very briefly, in McLean. Then to look at this image of some of the questions that he has raised in this book as a metaphor for how we live in the questions. Then what I'd like to do is spend a little time eliciting from you questions that are burning for you. A little play on the image of fire. What are the questions that burn in your heart about your faith? And talk about what living into those questions might mean. And then I'm going to end the session with sort of just a commentary about where McLean has answered the question, where in the world is God? Because I think his answer, at least for me, was helpful. And if you haven't finished the book, this isn't going to give away anything. It's not like if you read the last three pages, you'll give away the plot of the book. So I'm going to sort of finish with some commentary from the book tonight at the end of the session. I'd like to begin by just reading one paragraph from McLean. There'll be some readings tonight, so if you can't hear, if I read too fast, please let me know. This is toward the end of his book. At the University of Chicago, there is this strange sculpture. I've walked by it several times. That, depending on which way you look at it, it looks like an atomic mushroom or a skull. Some of you may be familiar. I'm seeing a couple heads nodding back there. And McLean, obviously having been on that campus, reflects on the metaphor of fire, not only in the forest fire, but the potential for nuclear destruction in our age. And he says, the atomic mushroom has become for our age the outer symbol of our inner fear of the explosive power of the universe. I'll read that again. The atomic mushroom has become for our age the outer symbol of our inner fear of the explosive power of the universe. It is a symbol of a whole age, and it took an artist to express the meaning the mushroom has for us. Henry Moore, one of our age's most expressive sculptors, commemorated that occasion that led to the atomic age, the first self-sustained nuclear reaction on the site of the University of Chicago where it occurred. His bronze atomic mushroom with its hollow eyes is intentionally bivisual from every point of view. Wherever you stand, the bronze looks both like an atomic mushroom and a skull, and it's meant to. A little comment, keep that quote in mind as McLean reflects on the death of these firefighters. He said it was not, therefore, for most of them, a terrible death. Many of the bodies were terribly burned when they were found, so much so that later it was discovered that the casket should not have been brought into the funeral afterwards. Even so, they did not die of burning. The burning came afterwards. To project ourselves into their final thoughts will require feelings about a special kind of death. The sudden death in the fire of the young, the elite, the unfulfilled, and seemingly unconquerable. As the elite of young men, they felt more surely than most who are young that they were immortal. So if we are to feel with them, we must feel that we are set apart from the rest of the universe and safe from fires, all of which are expected to be put out by 10 o'clock in the morning after smoke jumpers are dropped on them. As to what they felt about sudden death, we can start by feeling what the unfulfilled always feel about it. And since the unfulfilled are many, the Book of Common Prayer cries out for all of them and us when it begs that we all be delivered from sudden death. Good Lord, deliver us. From lightning and plague, from earthquake, fire, and flood, from plague, pestilence, famine, from battle and murder, from sudden death. Good Lord, deliver us. One thing is certain about these final thoughts. There was not much size to them. Time and place did not permit even superior young men suddenly to see their whole lives pass in review, although books portray people preparing to die as seeing a sort of documentary of their lives. Everything, however, gets smaller on its way to becoming eternal. It is also probable that the final thoughts of the elite young men dying suddenly were not seeing or scenic thoughts, but were cries of a single cry of passion, often of self-compassion, justifiable if those who cried are justly proud. Okay. It's interesting that in this last part of Young Men and Fire that MacLean resorts to liturgical language, Book of Common Prayer, to try to deal with this image about the questions that the faith reveals. What can you say about the intense panic and fear? If you've been in a situation in which you're in some sort of inevitable danger, you know that sort of almost panic that sets in? I was reminiscing with, we were talking at the Hike House today, and I thought back to a group of students, the dumb things you do when you're younger, about a group I had taken out backpacking in Montana, and we had hiked up 13 miles up a trail, and the typical response, I said, bring rain gear along. This is before our camp sent out tents. We just sent out tarps for overnights. These high school kids from Minnesota brought along their Kmart rain jackets, with a tiny little hood and the little pockets on the side. And we got up to about 10,000 feet, and by 11 o'clock at night, it had socked in with fog and was pouring rain, and they were soaking wet. And if you know anything about hypothermia, two of them were already shivering to pieces. And at about 1 o'clock in the morning, the other adult leader and I decided that it was time to hike back. So we packed up all their gear and hiked 13 miles down in the night with two flashlights and crossed two creeks in waist-deep, ice-cold river water. And finally, at 4 o'clock in the morning, got back to the camp. That's one of the few times that I have ever felt that sense of, first of all, of complete exhaustion. I don't think I've ever been that tired in my entire life. Second, incredible sense of fear. We had one girl nearly go under. When you cross creeks, you know that when you're backpacking, you loosen all those belts, and she forgot to do that, and the backpack tipped her back, and she went under the creek and came up out. It was a sense of, by the time we got back to the camp we were at, of course, I was only about 20 years old at that time, and it was a sense of thinking, there's a certain invincibility to life, a certain sense that, well, nothing's going to happen, and thank God it didn't. You look back at that, but you realize in those moments how tenuous, how short, how chaotic life can be. When I think of that image of our theme this week, water washed and spirit born, sometimes being water washed isn't all that pleasant. We forget about the sort of death imagery that's also present in baptism, and the destructive and all-consuming energy that's present in fire. Fire is that which warms our hearts and lights our lives, but it also destroys lives and tears down people's houses. And so there's a sort of double-edged image to both water and fire that I think are interesting if we take them as metaphors for our faith. As metaphors for our faith. That the fire of the Spirit, that which kindles and nourishes, is also the flame that purifies, that in a sense kills. And MacLean struggles with this in this book. Periodically the word fire will be capitalized. So it's interesting to try to figure out whether he's talking about God in that, or whether he's talking about it as some sort of force in the universe, some power that the fire has. But those forces in life that allow us to live in ambiguity is what this whole week is about. We talked a little bit last night about the posture of faith that allows us to live into the questions of tragedy. It would have been easy, I think, for MacLean to have found a way to try to rationalize this fire, to explain it away, to sentimentalize it, or worse yet, to forget the victims. And what he has done in this story is to give voice. By the end of this story, you know all these characters, and you know these young men's lives. And somehow, at the end of the book, when you weep at the last page, it's because you have been so drawn into these young men's lives that you can't help but feel the struggle through which they've gone. So part of MacLean's strategy of this book is to further, I think, the science of firefighting so this doesn't happen again, but to bring to voice the kinds of pain and struggle that these families went through at the loss of their children and their siblings and their relatives and friends when these young men died. And to say that what the faith is about is finally living into questions, allowing those spots that burn in our hearts, that consume us, to be places actually of hope and transformation. But it only comes after years of struggling and living with those questions. Comments or questions at this point? Comments? Okay, I'm going to try not to keep just reading quotes at you all night, but I've started including this little piece in my freshman syllabus when I teach introductory religion, and it's called The Search for God, Living the Questions. And I'm just going to read a little bit of it, and I want you to think about questions that you have been through in your life, particularly as it relates to suffering, to tragedy, to evil. We haven't even begun to define those words, and we could spend a whole nother week trying to distinguish suffering from evil, from tragedy. How are all those linked? But situations in which you have had to struggle with the question of God's presence in the world and pain and suffering. This says, teachers can only be teachers when there are students who want to be students. Without a question, an answer is experienced as manipulation. Without a struggle, help is considered interference. And without the desire to learn, the offer to teach is easily felt as oppression. Therefore, our first task is not to offer information, advice, or even guidance, but to allow others to come into touch with their own struggles, pains, doubts, and insecurities. In short, to affirm their life's quest. Now, I read that as someone who teaches first-year religion. I want you to think about that now as someone who relates to another in the midst of suffering and pain. We spent last night's session kind of carrying out the implications of this incarnational faith. How do we talk about resisting evil? How do we talk about participating in overcoming suffering and evil? How do we live in the questions that are troubling? Listen to this sentence again. Therefore, our first task, and we might say as Christians, or our first task of faith, is not to offer information, advice, or even guidance, but to allow others to come into touch with their own struggles, pains, doubts, and insecurities. In short, to affirm their life's quest. That is quite a difficult task since it runs counter to the mainstream of education that wants to give knowledge to understand, skills to control, and power to conquer. In religious education, we encounter a God who cannot always be understood. We discover realities that cannot be controlled. And we realize that our hope is hidden not in the possession of power, but in the confession of weakness. As long as a religion is perceived by the student and treated by the teacher as another field to be mastered, with competition, grades, and rewards, only hostility and resentment can be expected. What needs affirmation is the validity of these questions. Questions like, who am I? Where am I going? And what is my purpose in life? What needs to be said is, yes, yes, these are the questions. Don't hesitate to raise them. Don't be afraid to enter into them. Teaching religion, and we might put in experiencing the Christian faith, therefore, is first of all the affirmation of the basic human quest for meaning. Teaching means the creation of the space in which the validity of the questions does not depend on the availability of answers, but on their capacity to open us to new perspectives and new horizons. Teaching means to allow all the daily experiences of life, such as loneliness, fear, and anxiety, and the long cry for love, to be recognized as part of the quest for meaning. Thus, to be a teacher, or to be a faithful one, means first of all not to deny but to affirm the search, to allow for painful questions to be raised. This means that we must constantly avoid the temptation to be easy defenders of God, the church, the tradition, or whatever else we feel called to defend. Experience suggests that such glib apologetics animate in students only hostility and anger, and finally a growing alienation from whom or what we are trying to defend. All teachers of religion are constantly in danger of becoming like Job's friends, anxiously avoiding the painful search and nervously filling the gap created by unanswerable questions. I read that with, yes?
Well, it just reminds me of Nell Morton's book, Journeys Home. In this book, at one point, she describes the Holy Spirit, or God, as the biggest listener ever. And indeed, the Pentecost event, instead of thinking as God sort of putting things for the disciples to say, is the Holy Spirit hearing the disciples into speech. And if you think about that, I mean, before, you know, he risen from the dead, he'd gone into heaven, they must have had endless questions. And the Holy Spirit is essentially just hanging on there for as long as it took until... So that metaphor of hearing into speech is in some ways the same thing as what you're describing there. And it means a deep down listening that waits.
That's an interesting comment. I've never thought of Pentecost that way. I mean, that's a wonderful image, that Pentecost becomes the place to which God listens to the voices raised, to the questions raised. That's wonderful. And God is being the one who listens with as the greatest listener. Often in cases, I know at least for me, when we took all our training for clinical pastoral education, some of the worst things you can do is to offer sort of premature answers. You know, somebody will say, well, why did, you know, you have a tragedy in the family, a small child dies, and you run in and say, well, I'm sure it's because God wanted your little angel in heaven. Or whatever sort of response immediately comes that doesn't allow one to listen into the question that the person has. Very often, and I love that last sentence about those who are anxious to fill in the gap. It's painful, isn't it, to listen, to hear into what somebody's questions really are. And it's usually my discomfort level. You're kind of sitting there thinking, what am I going to say? Should I offer them guidance? Should I try to say something nice? I really don't know how they feel, but what should I say? When very often what needs to be done is to listen to where they are in the midst of their own questions and struggles. And to offer glib solutions, of course, means that they don't work for everybody, because not everybody's experience of suffering and pain and evil are the same. They're very contextualized in the sense that we live out of our own experience. So I think theology comes in then as this act of listening and this art of raising questions in a way that becomes what I call located, particularized to the situations and context out of which one tries to struggle with those questions. Where I think typically we have tried to offer sort of, you know, certain sorts of answers that have worked. And like I said, there's been such a critique of the typical response to what is known as theodicy, the question of God's goodness and power and suffering in the world. I've mentioned these books in other sessions, and I'll keep mentioning them if you're interested. Kathleen Sand's book, Escape from Paradise, I think is one of the finest pieces I've read in the last few years on this question of suffering and evil, because what she's talking about is a movement to attend back to the stories of people's lives and then try to understand where God is in the world, instead of constructing a theology first that fits. So it's really a reversal. Yes?
Would you comment then on whether or not you see the religious right, those seeking definite theological answers or dogma as a way to calm their fears, do you see that then as an escape from the invitation all of us have to listen further to our question and to face the pain of unanswered questions?
Well, in a straightforward way, yes, but I think I gave the example last night, and I think I could probably come back to that. The students, the single biggest growing movement on our campus is Fellowship of Christian Athletes.
What?
Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Some of you are familiar with that. It's a large movement on our campus. We have a campus of about 1,500 students, and anywhere from 100 to 300 students are involved with Fellowship of Christian Athletes, which, at least in its rhetoric, in its piety, in its conversation, tends to be those ones who want to search for answers and solutions, and it has something in common with the religious right. That group is usually, I don't know if this is saying something I should or not, they're usually praying for the chaplain in our religion department. They're usually the ones in trouble. I've had more than a number of students saying, yes, FCA just prayed for you the other night. So, and part of what I want to honor, though, in their search is that we spent a whole week talking about living in the questions, raising the questions, but we also have a need for order, for answers, for comfort. And one of the passages, I'd have to look it up again tonight, but that McLean talks about is that there's a drive within each of us that has to wrestle with the disorderly and the orderly, with the messiness and the neatness of life. And that what theology is about, or what the Christian faith is about, is learning how to live in that tension. So on the one hand, what the religious right is doing, it has a certain drive that's part of all of us. The fear that I have with that is that it leads to a theology, I think, that leaves out the voices of those, for instance, who are not easy to listen to, whose questions are written off, whose pain and suffering are not part of the in crowd. So I'm always a little bit suspicious of that. And of course, it's built into our Lutheran, I shouldn't say our, not everybody in this room, it's built into my Lutheran bones. It's built into the tradition as a Lutheran to struggle. I mean, that's Luther's metaphor of faith. The German word is anfechten, you know, struggling, wrestling with, throwing inkwells at the devil. If you've read Luther, you know how engaged Luther is with questioning back and forth. So there's a way in which faith frees one to engage in those questions. Because we know our salvation isn't dependent, first of all, on the answers. And I think it's the place out of which, if most of us are honest, we have those questions. And often, faith is associated with lack of doubt. Certainty, not having questions. Most of my students say, but if I'm really a believing Christian, I shouldn't have any doubts or I shouldn't have any questions. I'll just trust. And so we talk about what trust means. I mean, it's a very odd thing if you marry somebody and you just say, well, I don't know anything about you, but I guess I'll just jump into a relationship with you anyway. Of course, frightfully, that's what some of them are doing anyway, but there's a sense of sort of how you look relationally at allowing God to be the one who listens to our questions. I still like that image. That's wonderful. Yeah. Other comments? Yes?
If I'm a 16-year-old black male in inner city Chicago, and I have nothing but questions, I have probably not much hope. How does all this fit in, and where does that message come from for a great number of people in this country that do nothing but struggle, have nothing but questions? And I'm, you know, it's kind of like this great void.
I would hope it wouldn't be to dig the void deeper.
I mean, my strategy with that, and it's very hard for me to speak out of that kind of context. I'm not in that situation.
Me too. I'm not either.
But I think that goes back. There's, you know, this very opening thing. It says, without a question, an answer is experienced as manipulation. Without a struggle, it's considered interference. And if you don't have the question, it can be manipulative. It can be interference. But I think there's a sense for me in which the community, and I just keep going back to this more and more. I think this is the power for me about Luther's notion. A couple sessions ago, we talked about Luther's notion of the incarnation. And the fact that the place that you find the answers is also the community out of which the questions have arisen. And I think that needs to be an important concern. I can't begin to try to answer questions or to try to help. You know, I think that can be experienced, and we even talk about that cross-culturally a little bit. You know, to try to answer other people's questions for whom I have no experiential basis can be a very manipulative experience at some level. So it becomes, I think, a conversation in which those people who are in touch with that kind of experience need to listen about what that kind of despair is. And we then, who are not part of that experience, can from our place in the world begin to listen to that and to find out how to struggle with that. Am I getting at anything?
Yeah. I think your point is that the answers come from within.
Right.
Wherever that may be.
Any reflections on that question? I think that's a really important question. Karen?
Well, as one who lives in Chicago, one of the ways in which I think that is happening is in terms of the whole movement to a new way of building communities in inner city communities, not so much the outsider coming in with the answers, be that the outside social workers or whatever, but Joy Kretzmann, who I think was early, probably may have spoken on this earlier here this summer, asset-based community development. You know, how does one really begin to find the resources in the people, no matter how they might look, quote, deprived to us from the outside, to begin to see in which how that asset-based community development can happen there rather than, you know, someone kind of providing the answers. And it strikes me it has a similar kind of dynamic to what I think you're talking about.
I think that's surely true. I think just educationally, I think for the situation in the Dakotas and I know Montana, I've gone to several conferences on education, and a lot of the tribal colleges participate. And it's very clear that education is working better in some settings out of the tribal context when they're creating their own community colleges and working with that, than in which they try to come to Augustana. And there's absolutely no infrastructure or support to sustain, you know, the kinds of educational needs and issues that come out of a different community. So there's been a lot of conversation at that level. And I think that's why that quote is so interesting to me, because if you think of situations in your life, how often, if maybe you've experienced the loss of a parent, and if you connect with somebody else who's experienced the loss of a parent, there's an immediate sort of bonding. People will say, oh, I understand how that feels. I went through this, or I went through such and such. Where oftentimes, if the person who has no connection with your experience tries to offer some advice for it, it can feel a little interfering. It can feel well-intentioned, but maybe not helpful to you immediately, because there isn't that experience to connect to. So I think that's why I've really struggled with these questions of suffering and evil. I've become much more nervous with both the history of philosophy and the history of theology's sort of prescribed answers, the free will defense, the whatever, you know, and you can sort of list them out in your textbook, and then people, and then try to apply it to a concrete situation. Where if you start from the situation that you've raised and say, well, how do we look at this situation? What are the questions? What are the issues? And then begin to find out what the theological questions are. Maybe those constructs that we put, those answers, those solutions, don't often work very well anyway. You you know, bits and pieces of them. I always find myself sort of putting together an amalgamated construct anyway. So I guess I just keep going back to this notion that we need to begin in the particular, in the local, in the situation that you've experienced the suffering and tragedy, and try to let that be the breeding ground for raising the theological questions.
I don't think you're saying, though, that we have to have experienced something in order to be helpful or healing to another person.
Oh, not at all. No, I think I'm going to do a little bit, this coming with sort of an advertisement for next week, but how does one move into another's shoes? How does one, and I think the fact is all of us as human beings experience vulnerability and pain and at that point can connect with. And again, listening to that other person is an act, that's just what we've been saying, the listening itself is an act of compassion. I think one of the greatest gifts that one can offer is a truly attentive ear. That in itself can be transforming. And in that sense, you don't have to have had the experience.
And not only that, to be able to say, if you're listening to somebody at the moment, mm-hmm. to say, I'm always here. I'm a good listener. If you, you know, a week mm-hmm. from now, if you want to talk again, I'm here.
I think about a situation, I think I mentioned this a couple sessions ago. I went to England during January with another colleague, and I've gotten to know my massage therapist rather well. A couple years ago, I had some upper back and shoulder problems, and the doctor, it's a great prescription, once a week at the massage therapist. So believe me, when you go week after week after week, you get to know this person, and she had not been out of the country, had not had a vacation, self-employed, kids in high school, decided that she would come on our trip to England. So for 3 weeks, and luckily I wasn't the one taking advantage, but all the students would line up at Mary Ann's door every night and say, I think I have a backache up here, or I have a head which is wonderful person to have. After we returned from England, she had a senior in high school who that January had signed a contract with Creighton University in Omaha to play basketball, NCAA Division I. She was one of the top senior high school basketball players in Sioux Falls at Roosevelt High School. Her mother came back a week after England, and her daughter blew her brains out in their bathroom and committed suicide. And I called. It was one of the worst phone calls I've ever made. I called the house that night. Gary and I are using her saxophone. So I called that night, and I said, I'd like to bring over your saxophone. And her other daughter said, Shannon isn't here. And I said, what do you mean? And she screamed, she committed suicide. Would you come over? So speaking of having no experience, no, I mean, I've never felt so inadequate, so wordless, so empty, so horrified, and just sat with the mother for about a half hour and said, I can't say anything. I mean, I don't even know what to offer other than, and it became real important that over the next few weeks, both this other leader and I had lunch with Mary Ann about once a week to just let her talk, to try to sort it through. And at points, for her to raise questions like, I don't know what to do if she committed suicide, did she go to hell? I mean, all those kinds of awful things that you can raise abstractly but now become deeply personal became, she had to work those through. And I could only offer what I thought were sort of my responses out of the tradition. And that wonderful text we heard preached on last Sunday, which is nothing can separate us from God's love, became the only sort of response that I could offer. But that was that incarnational act. I mean, I didn't know how to respond other than to sort of be with her and to listen. And it's difficult.
You know, I think, I lost my mom 2.5 years ago, and I think as a society, people, you know, are there for you immediately, and mm-hmm. they're very sympathetic for maybe the first week, a week and a half. And then it's like after this time frame, mm-hmm. maybe a week and a half, you're supposed to be tough and get on with your life. And, you know, that's what I'm saying, that's where I think we need to be able to say, anytime, mm-hmm. I'm here for you, because I think that's when the questions are there, and that's when you need somebody to be there. And I had the feeling that my peers just didn't want to talk about it. The more I wanted to talk, but they really didn't want to listen. You know, they, you know, they were there. They felt like they had done their duty by being there at first, and it was like, get a grip and get on with it.
The shock wears off.
And yeah, and we need to be willing to leave the door always open.
Mm-hmm. I think so too.
It takes you 4 years. Yeah. On the average.
Yeah, I think it does take a
while. To break that mm-hmm. and be back to normal.
Yeah. Over here and then over here. Yes?
A couple things. Going back to the note, you know, the initial thing about the young man.
Mm-hmm.
Had they volunteered to go?
The smoke jumping had to, yeah, I mean, they were giving their summers, they were being paid, not very much, but the smoke jumping, if I remember Plainwright, had really only started after World War II, so the smoke jumping school had only been around for a couple years. This was a new experience to be jumping into the forest fire. So in essence, these were like Holden volunteers in many ways. Young men, in this case all men, but young men who had maybe a summer between their senior year in high school and graduate school, or I mean college, or were in graduate school, said many of them were highly educated. A couple, I think one man was only 17.
My comment is then that if they were not coerced to go there,
mm-hmm.
then they made a choice. And they knew that there were fires. And so I have a little bit of a problem, unless I'm missing the point altogether, seeing why this author was moved to call in the question. I would rather think of, well, maybe they've lived a pretty full life and made some choices, some hard choices, and probably look and celebrate the life that they've lived. They only lived to be 20 or 18 or whatever. Quality of life, I don't think it has to do with its length necessarily. Then the other thing is about Lutherans and so-called religious right. I think you'll find within among Lutherans across the country, you'll find many who could have very comfortable fellowship with the most right religious right.
Oh, sure.
And others that very liberal and unconcerned about the traditions, who could have fellowship with groups that are like that, you know.
I was just trying to make the distinction that I think Lutheran theology, a Lutheran perspective, has something to offer that I think, in many ways, at least from my perspective, is not similar to the religious right. But we could get into a whole discussion of that. In terms of
we seem to divorce ourselves from that whole community of faith, and mm-hmm. I think we do that to our own detriment.
That might be an arguable, you know, point, and I don't. At some point, we might want to engage that question. I'm not too willing to do that tonight, so that we
no.
can. But I understand. I appreciate your point. And in terms of the nature of the young men, I think for McLean, I mean, we all make choices about where we live and what we do. And of course, the tragedy of this fire is that they didn't expect. As you read the story, what happens is a blow up, which is this special kind of fire that it's literally like an atomic mushroom. And these men were not prepared for that. They didn't understand that kind of fire. The other tragedy that happens, of course, in the story is that one of the men, the head of the fire crew, the foreman, builds a special fire within the fire. And if I understand all this right, the fire, once that has burned out and there's no oxygen, the main fire will pass over, and he saved his life that way. So part of the story is the fact that this tragedy engulfs these young men who were supposedly the best, the most prepared, the elite and yet with all their skills could not overcome what is a consuming fire. And these are lives cut off. Yes.
And I think to put it in perspective, we could refer to the most recent fire in Colorado. Mm-hmm. We lost a neighbor in this parents live up 2 miles up the road from a fire in Colorado. And it's far more complicated. It's a very, very complex issue. It's not just a choice to go in and fight a fire. It's a matter of there's the fire, they're trained, they need these people, and a lot of other people are making decisions for them. Mm-hmm. There are weather reports that are misread. There are leaders on the ground that are directing them. There are observation points that may where they may have missed something. The parents of Don Mackey, who was the leader of this group in Colorado, are agonizing all this. And the biggest tragedy here is they have no faith. Mm-hmm. And without a Christian faith, they're tearing themselves apart. But that's not the issue. The issue is not a simple
right.
decision to go in and fight the fire. It's an extremely complex series of decisions made by a lot of different people and a lot of different factors that choosing that particular place, the weather mm-hmm. changes, it's very complicated.
Yes. But for the survivors, misrepresentation, the lack of honesty, the failure to give the reports, the changing from this to this to this to this, has kept the survivors mm-hmm. in just a state of agony.
Well, and McLean makes it clear that through the story, the survivors, two of the men went back with him up the Man Gulch Ridge and talked about the fact that they, I mean, you can imagine, watches were frozen into place. Men were burned with parts of flesh fall. I mean, he has these incredible details. While these young men watched their colleagues dying in this fire, and they never really overcame that. McLean talks about the incredible grief and why did I survive? Sometimes the painful question is why wasn't I the one who was killed in the fire? So these kinds of questions that rise out of this, along with the very complex, and I think that's one thing that I grew to appreciate about the nature of suffering and evil. It's not just simply a clear-cut situation. There's a lot of ambiguity and complexity and detail that one has to sort out in figuring out what the questions are. We'll go here. Yes.
I like your idea about contextualizing by listening to the stories. Mm-hmm. It seems like in some of the funerals that I recently attended, we're back to stories. The first time I experienced it was when my dad died. And at the wake and at the funeral, people stood up and told stories about my dad. And it was just so overwhelming to hear people talking about my dad in ways that I had never known.
Yeah.
And it answered some questions for me
mm-hmm.
That if stories hadn't been told, probably wouldn't have been answered. I got a chance to listen and get some questions answered. And I think sometimes as a culture, we're so afraid about dying that we're not living.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, part of what I think about for those young men is they chose to live life very fully with death right at their threshold
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, they were living in the moment, and many of
exactly.
us are afraid of dying, and from an intellectual point of view anyway,
mm-hmm.
not from the experience, but if we believe that death brings us a very strong relationship mm-hmm. with God, why are we fearing it?
I think you can spend your whole life fearing death and missing the life, and that's mm-hmm. I think it's a wonderful thing.
They seem, I mean, those young men were
in the face of it.
In the face of it, and yeah. going forward. Wow.
Ruthie, and then here in that area.
Well, I'd like to tell a story, but this isn't mine. It's a story told to me by Fred Neithner, who's a member of the Holden Board, and mm-hmm. he was here teaching Bible study at the time that the fires were threatening Holden Village, exactly 2 years ago. Mm. And there were community meetings to tell people what to do. Perhaps some of you were here. We were supposed to come in and didn't at that time. Here's what we will do when we get the alarm.
Uh-huh.
No one was allowed to go out on the trails, and there was real danger. And what we would do was go up on the tailings. And what Fred made of that was to say, isn't it something that the point of our salvation is the point of destruction?
Mm.
You know, so there's a certain metaphor of purification there. That the awful scar on this land has been transformed into a place where we would find safety.
Thank you.
Well, I was just going to say, sort of coming off from what you said, I think 12-step groups throughout the United States and throughout the world are metaphors that live the question. And it's precisely, number one, people are located. You're a drug addict, you're an alcoholic, you're an overeater, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And you share that, and you are connected with the need. You know your need. That's mm-hmm. the other thing. You know your need. And one of the things I think is expected is that people be honest on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things the church has not helped us understand is grace allows us to be honest about the down-to-earth daily stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's what grace is calling out of us, you know. And these groups say, you need to do this if you expect to stay, whatever it is you need to stay, you know.
One of my seminary professors said the best way to understand Lutheran theology is to go to AA meetings. So, yeah. Well, you think of the steps, you admit you're powerless, and you know, on the fifth step where there's fourth and fifth, I mean, it's a powerful system and a very connected, that's a wonderful example. Okay, we'll take this.
You touched on quite a bit about what we do with other people's questions. Mm-hmm. But what do we do with our own?
We'll have about 4 minutes left, and I'm going to try to leave you with what McLean did with his own and read you the last paragraph in the book and see if that helps. Because I think he's more eloquent at saying that than I am. Okay? For me, they keep coming up in new and different ways. Somebody once told me, you sort of have the same five tunes in your life, you just play them differently for your whole life. The questions have remained pretty much the same for me, but they have changed and been transformed and encountered in new ways. Some answered.
Yeah. Oh, I thought that what occurred to me as people were talking about people dying and that mm-hmm. particular form of suffering and loss, that I think it's important, I think, not to let faith be a way to say, well, we shouldn't somehow or another suffer the human dimension mm-hmm. of what's happened. And when my mom died, I know that she went straight to heaven. I have no doubt mm-hmm. of that whatsoever. But I was in terrible grief, for a long time, too. And it doesn't take away the grief of the survivors.
No.
And if I understood what you were saying about McLean, he was talking about the family's questions and not mm-hmm. trying to justify the lives of the young men. If I understood what the lady was saying.
What he's trying to do is not sentimentalize or take away their grief, but to let it be, to let them live in their grief.
The grief of the families.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The grief is normal. And the questions, too.
Exactly.
Especially if somebody's killed in an unjust kind of way.
Yeah. It sort of doubles the intensity.
Exactly.
Take one more. Yes.
I would just like to mention that there are worse things. And Dick, mm-hmm. and in our family, the worst thing is a son with schizophrenia.
Mm.
I think one of the important things for the church is to help parents be honest in that situation,
mm-hmm.
because that was once something that we had to be ashamed about. And the other thing is to help them realize that Christ is with you in that suffering, even though the future changes.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful, I mean, there are things for which we have been shameful of, which we haven't named, that need that attention, and I think the notion of Christ being with us in that is, for me, the power of where MacLean ends, and I'm going to just end with a couple of lines from MacLean, because I think he's, again, a little bit more evocative than me. He takes the metaphor, there are lots of metaphors through the book, and of course one is of the skyjumper, and he links that to the image of Jesus as the one who comes from the sky. He said, the pity that remains is perhaps the last and only emotion felt if it is the young and unfulfilled who suffer their tragedy. It is pity in the form of self-pity, but the compassion felt for themselves by the tragic young is self-pity transformed into some divine bewilderment. One of the few emotions in which the young and the universe are the only characters. Although divine bewilderment addresses its grief to the universe, it only cries out to it. It has to find its answer, if at all, in its own final act. It is not to be found among the answers God gave to Job in the whirlwind. The most eloquent expression of this cry was made by a young man who came from the sky and returned to it, and who, while on earth, knew he was alone and beyond all men, and who, when he died, died on a hill. About the ninth hour, he cried out with a loud voice, my God, why have you forsaken me? Although we can enter their last thoughts and feelings only by indirection, we are sure of the final act of many of them. And thus he ends with his last paragraph about his wife's death from cancer and about the young man. He says, I, an old man, have written this fire report. Among other things, it was important to me as an exercise for my old age to enlarge my knowledge and spirit so I could accompany young men whose lives I might have lived on their way to death. I might accompany them on their way to death. I have climbed where they climbed, and in my time I have fought fire and inquired into its nature. In addition, I have lived to get a better understanding of myself and those close to me, many of them now dead. Perhaps it is not odd, at the end of this tragedy, where nothing much was left of the elite who came from the sky, but courage struggling for oxygen, that I have often found myself thinking of my wife on her brave and lonely way to death. I think MacLean says it well enough that I will leave it with that. If you have comments or questions, I'll be glad to talk with you for a brief time. Vespers is almost near. This will end our series together, and I've appreciated your participation and comments. Any questions? Okay, we'll see you Monday if you're still around with a new series. Okay, thank you.